Gateway Market and Cafe is Des Moines' locally owned grocery and specialty food store, centrally located at ML King Parkway and Woodland Ave. Enjoy chef-crafted prepared foods, artisan baked goods, organic produce, hand-cut meats, local and international cheeses, wines, and craft beer. Gateway's Cafe is open for dine-in, carry-out, and delivery service 7 days a week. Stop by or visit gatewaymarket.com for more details. Gateway Market, good food, great community. Welcome to the Fallon Forum. Hey, thanks to our sponsors, including Gateway Marketing Cafe. Gateway brings together the world's finest products with Iowa-grown foods and passionate personalized service. Check out Gateway Marketing Cafe. Thanks also to Central Iowa Realtor Joe Henry, who's got 23 years of experience in the real estate business. He's also a leading community activist and a strong advocate for locally owned businesses. Contact Joe Henry at 515-208-7312. Hey, thanks for joining us today, folks, and a quick shout-out to the Des Moines Irish Session for our bumper music. Later in the program, Kathy and I are going to be discussing the new food pyramid, which kind of flips the whole, you know, food issue on its head. We'll also be talking about Donald Trump and how the Trump administration is bumping up against the rule of law when it comes to how they're dealing with ICE holdees in county jails. And we'll also talk about the very inspiring Buddhist monks who are walking for peace across the U.S. But first, I'm delighted to have Zach Lascaris with me. He's an attorney in Minneapolis, St. Paul. He's a lifelong resident of the Twin Cities. He's been active with the group called ICE Watch, and he's been witnessing ICE enforcement actions and has taken a couple related cases pro bono. Zach, welcome to the program.
Hey, Ed, thank you very much for having me. I'm really happy to, I'm here to talk about sort of the things that's been happening in our community and hopefully give a view to people who are not living in the Twin Cities, kind of what's happening to us living here.
Well, I appreciate that. Now, it's January 12th when we are recording this conversation, and ICE has, let's just call it what it is, been terrorizing the streets of your city for a couple weeks now. And yes. despite the pushback, they're now talking about deploying, hundreds, if not over 1,000 more ICE agents to Minneapolis?
Yes, and they've already deployed. I mean, I believe the original deployment was somewhere around 2,000 agents, and now they're saying, yes, an additional 500 to 1,000 agents are going to be deployed in the next couple of days. Apparently based on the, the unwillingness of local citizens to kind of put up with what is essentially, as you're saying, it's terrorism. It's people are having their doors kicked in, buildings, residences entered without warrants, people dragged out of their homes. Really, it's like horrible, nightmarish stuff that you wouldn't imagine happening in a major American city like this, especially not under the kind of the eye of the federal government who is perpetuating all of this.
Yeah. And I know your mayor has been very outspoken and very clear about where he stands. He's very much opposed to the ICE intervention. And I want to play a clip from a recent press conference he gave regarding how he views the protests ought to be conducted.
The vast majority of people have protested peacefully, recognizing that I have seen community members sort of step into the breach, recognizing that there are others out there, agitators that are trying to rile up large crowds. This is what Donald Trump wants. He wants us to take the bait.
Is that your impression, too, that peaceful, overall, the protests have been peaceful?
Yes. So I've been out to a few different ICE actions, just as an observer, just, people coming out to express, how they feel about the situation. And everything I've seen has been almost isn't entirely peaceful. I've seen the only real violence I've seen has been on the actions of ICE agents or affiliated federal agents and officers. I've seen middle-aged women very similar to Ms. Good who, were just standing around or holding signs or, just saying how they felt, not even yelling. And then I've seen ICE officers push them to the ground, smack them out of the way. And these are, full-grown men just knocking around you know, the kind of woman that looks like my mother. Yeah. It's really grotesque when you see it.
And, yeah, we've seen it. We've seen clips on the news, of course, and you're seeing it firsthand. And it's not, I mean, my impression is that there's a huge community response in opposition to this. But, again, all that Donald Trump is doing is doubling down and sending more ICE agents.
Yeah, well, it's, what's confusing about this is, yeah, I'm a part of a few sort of just online groups, community groups, just people I know. This, you know, it's organized in the sense that I have neighbors and other people who I know where I live who've asked me if I want to participate in this. And I said, yeah, because I don't want, you know, I want to make sure that anything that's happening in our cities is done legally and done morally correctly. And I don't think either of those things are true with what ICE has been doing here.
And you're in addition to your mayor speaking out pretty strongly, your three of your members of Congress have been speaking out as well, including a visit to the ICE detention facility, which, according to my understanding of federal law, they should be required or allowed. There's no grounds on which to deny them access to a federal facility. That's my impression. And here's a clip from a conversation about that on CBS News Minnesota.
U.S. Reps Ilhan Omar, Angie Craig, and Kelly Morrison came face-to-face with the line of federal agents before asking to be let inside the Whipple Federal Building at Fort Snelling. Inside, they say they intended to tour the facility, used as a hub for the 2,000 federal agents in town and the temporary home for many under arrest. The trio also requested a face-to-face meeting with ICE's acting director for the area. 20 minutes later, they returned.
Shortly after we were let in, two officials came in and said that they received a message that we were no longer allowed to be in the building and that they were rescinding our invitation to come in and declining any further access to the building. What happened today is a blatant attempt to obstruct members of Congress from doing their oversight duties.
And that's a, you know, it's interesting to me that they were allowed in initially and then apparently got a call from on high somewhere in Washington, D.C., and were told, and the personnel at the facility were told to reject them, you know, get them out of there.
I mean that's scary in its own right. I can't speak to the competence, you know, of ICE agents or the ICE administration in terms of, like, you know, if the right hand knows what the left hand is doing in terms of letting, you know, letting Congress people act, they're constitutionally allowed access to these facilities. Yeah. To me, what's really scary about that story is that, I mean, that sort of opacity coming from the federal government has been sort of the standard for how this whole situation has gone. We hear nothing from the feds. They basically treat our state representatives, our state police as enemies. Like, well, I know that they're not cooperating. I'm investigating the murder of Mrs. Good. And so, yeah, there is, and that's just another example of how this is just sort of being, we're being treated like enemies. We're being treated like we're being occupied. Like this is Baghdad or Fallujah or somewhere else, you know, in sort of the American, somewhere where the American military, it's in the way that ICE is now patrolling the streets here in Minneapolis.
Yeah, and in the words of President Trump regarding Somalis, they are, quote, garbage.
And I mean, that's just, I mean, I say the word grotesque a lot, but honestly, I mean, he's describing people who live in a community with me. And, you know, no community is perfect. I'm not going to say that everything in Minnesota is hunky-dory in terms of relations between different ethnic groups, Somali people, white people, black people, Hmong people, anybody. But, you know, it is a community and we are working these things out ourselves. And so that to him to say that these people are garbage is just like, you know, I don't see eye to eye with every Somali person in Minnesota on all the issues, but they're not garbage. They're my neighbors. I go, you know, I go swimming at the YMCA. The people in the pool next to me are Somali people. And this is, they're in part of my community. They take their kids there. You know, we shop together. We eat together. We live in the same streets together. We take the bus together, you know. And to say that these people are garbage and that the people in this community are just like, you know, don't belong here, you have no right to say that. This is our community. But, you know, he gets to go on the stage and rile up people who don't live here and get them all to try to hate people that they don't know. And I think that's, yeah. I mean, and the consequence of that is this violence and this death and this terror in our streets. And I think it's disgusting. And I think it's horrible. I don't know how anyone, and I'm sorry to go on, but I just don't know how anyone can attempt to be a leader and then just like treat the people they're supposed to be leading like that.
So is it primarily the Somali population that ICE has been targeting?
That's making the news a lot, but they're definitely not the only group of people who have been targeted. I have recently picked up a few immigration cases, a few pro bono, a few not, just because of the situation that's been going on. And I have clients from all, none of my clients are Somali, but they're all, you know, deeply scared. They're feeling targeted. There are groups of people who are not Somali who are going to courtrooms. You know, they're doing their business. They're relying on the system. And then they're being disappeared out of their hearings. And this is sort of like, I have to talk to my clients and, you know, they call me up. I get calls almost every day from clients who are terrified. You know, they're not sleeping. They're not eating. They feel like they can't leave their homes because they just will be disappeared and will never come back. And these are people who've lived in the country, you know, not 30 years. They have families, they have children, they have wives, they've buried their husbands here. And it's just, yeah, but these people are also being targeted. It doesn't matter, you know, your background. If you are an immigrant or if you, even if you look like you might not be white, you have been, you could be targeted. Because I've heard members of the Lakota and the Lawless Sioux communities have also been arrested by ICE, and they're certainly citizens. So lots of people, not just Somali people and not just non-citizens, have been targeted. And that's, I can say that for sure.
And other than the, besides the tragic death of Renee Good, have other, protesters, those opposed to ICE actions, have others been targeted with any kind of abusive response from ICE?
Well, I know a few protesters. There was a story that I noticed recently released where a protester, I guess, slammed their hands on the hood of a car and then was taken to an ICE facility. They were a citizen. There was no doubt about that. And just like they were intimidated, they were threatened. I think the ICE agents told them that they were white, so it would be no fun to play with them or something along those lines. And so, yeah, you have people just being picked up and threatened. Just like it's like the mafias in town.
Or an invading or an invading force, you know?
Exactly. So, yeah, no, it's scary. I mean, I've never seen anything like it. And yeah, to be an attorney and to have these clients, and I'm trying to convince my clients, you know, there's still a rule of law that we can rely on here. And it's hard for me to say that to clients because I have to try to convince myself, like, you know, maybe they're like, these people can get their day in court. They can have their voices heard because we have a legal system that lets them do that.
Yeah.
And then I think that for some reason, the people in power have just decided, you know what? We're just going to ignore that. It's just not what we want.
Yeah.
And it's just, I don't know. It's just so difficult to try to like believe in the American system when it's being abused.
And again, it's not just, some people say, oh, this is a one-time thing. This is, you know, Renee Good is not the only person who has been, you know, mistreated by ICE forces. Here's a clip from The Daily Show I want to share with people.
Now we have a massive new police force of poorly trained recruits hopped up on Rick Ross music, unleashed into American cities and suburbs. And for the past few months, federal agents have been terrorizing people in their own neighborhoods.
Over the past year, Americans have witnessed masked ICE agents detain mothers in front of their children, people shot by federal agents, and more than 170 U.S. citizens held inside detention centers.
A 79-year-old business owner says he was body slammed and pinned to the ground despite being a U.S. citizen.
Carlos Jimenez, a U.S. citizen, tried to drive around the officers when one shot him in the back of his shoulder.
Masked agents shot pepper balls at a pastor.
A woman who was handcuffed was suddenly being dragged by one arm.
Federal agents drag away a blind protester.
We kept yelling, she's pregnant, she's pregnant.
Yeah, I mean, those are clips from scenes around the country. Seems to be standard behavior. And part of it is, I mean, to me, you've got a force that is very, very ill-equipped to, I mean, they're not well-trained. And also, no. they've got carte blanche from the administration to kind of go all out and to not recognize the norms of conduct between law enforcement and the public expressing First Amendment rights.
Oh, yeah. I mean, these guys have 8 weeks of training, which is not nearly enough for the operations that they are conducting. And yeah, it does feel that there is just sort of an attitude amongst the administration, be it the president on down, of just sort of like, let her rip, you know, let them do whatever they want to do, hurt these people in these cities for daring to not vote for me or not agree with me or for how things should be. And it's just, yeah, it's not just, it is everywhere. I have friends They have had ICE, you know, parked outside of their child's daycare for hours at a time. You got ICE following people around, just trying to drag them off the streets, hurting people. I've been shot at with pepper balls, and I was just standing at a protest. You know, it's just.
Yeah. So what I mean, right now, the you know, instead of trying to address concerns about Rene Goode's killing, the Trump administration is not only not allowing an investigation to go forward, they're sending more troops. And at the same time, Governor Walz has said something about mobilizing the Minnesota National Guard to protect citizens, to protect people who are protesting. And is this potentially setting up a conflict, an armed conflict between local law enforcement and federal ICE agents?
I mean, as an attorney, I don't like to speculate about those sorts of things, but I mean, I think that's a reasonable understanding of the situation. I mean, if you have ICE agents acting inappropriately, using violence at the drop of a hat, and then they encounter, you know, a citizen or someone, and the National Guard tries to intervene, I can sincerely imagine they're just going to turn their guns on the National Guard. Like, it's a scary thought. It's a terrifying thought. I really don't want to countenance that. And I do applaud the governor for doing something to try to, you know, support the citizens of his state when they're being under attack like this. But yeah, I mean, we're entering a sort of wild west in many ways in terms of the law here. And the president's, I don't want to just clarify, I think the president and his actions and the actions of ICE and the executive are perpetuating that lawlessness for that, like, definitely. Like, clearly it's their bag.
And that's one thing that that Mayor Fry said too, is that, you know, we didn't have a problem here until I showed up. You know, the lawlessness that you claimed ICE was coming to protect American citizens from is only happening because you guys came.
I think, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I know that they put a lot of truck into the Feeding Our Future scandal, and it is an important scandal, but I would just kind of note with that, you know, Minnesota lawmakers, the Minnesota Attorney General's office are the people leading the way on prosecuting those frauds. Like, this is not an issue where the federal government has discovered something that the state is covering up. This is an issue the state was already dealing with
prior
to this. And now they're just now it seems like they're trying to use that as an excuse, to just come into this state. And yeah, now they've killed at least one person. They seem to be more than willing to kill again. And I'm just kind of, you know, it's, when you live here and these are people who you live next to, and these people like Ms. Goode, I remember hearing about her death the day I went to a memorial for a good family friend. And she was, just a good woman, good to her church, good to her community. But she had very similar political opinions to Ms. Goode in terms of she didn't like any of this stuff going on. She thought it was scary and she thought it was wrong. And I can just imagine, you know, if someone had murdered her, and the way that the president and the vice president of the country are talking about her like she's a terrorist, it's disgusting. Yeah, like, this is the kind of person, if you live in the Midwest, like, yeah, I know you said, you live in the Midwest, you've met a million women like this, and they're all lovely people.
Yeah, and opinionated.
Yeah. And that's like,
right.
You can't shoot someone for having an opinion you don't like.
Yeah.
Well, you can't shoot someone for honking their horn at you.
Yeah, you look at any of the videos, and it's hard to come away with any conclusion other than that she was murdered. But remarkably, I mean, I posted something about this on my Facebook page, and I have a pretty broad Facebook friend universe, not all on the political left, quite a few on, you know, other points in the political spectrum. And some of the responses were, you know, insisting that she was gunning her car at the officer. Just other claims that just didn't match what I saw. What I saw was pretty clear. This guy shot with no clear threat against him at all, and not just once, but three times. You know?
I mean, yeah, and I've seen. I don't like to watch these videos. I don't just because I don't like to watch the videos of humans being killed.
I don't blame you.
A hard thing to watch in any situation, but when it's happening in your community, again, I mean. The one thing I would kind of relate this to is when Derek Chauvin murdered George Floyd.
Mm-hmm.
That video came out, and you know, at the time, most of the Republican Party, or at least the conservative movement in America, at least went along with this idea that no, this is shocking and this is wrong. And there is this change now where you see a video, and I agree with you. I think it's pretty clear that at the very least, he wasn't in substantial danger of any kind when he fired his weapon. Like, that there can be a group of other people, and I don't know if they don't watch it or if they're just watching AI-generated stuff or if they just have been commanded to not see with their eyes by the president.
Well, I think that's a lot of it. I think you get a directive from President Trump that, hey, there's nothing to see here. She was innocent. She was guilty of being a professional protester and of gunning her car and who knows what else, and she got what she deserved. You hear that coming from the president, and yeah, a lot of his base is going to fall in line. I mean, you hear that on so many different issues. You know, Trump insists on something, and then, yeah, the base just dutifully follow along. Although I would say, and tell me what your opinion is of this, Zach. In my experience, there's a big chunk of the base. And even, when I say big chunk, I mean even of the 70 million who voted for him, several million, which is big in terms of political change. Several million people, just extrapolating that from the universe that I've had contact with, that are unhappy with multiple directions that this administration is going, whether it's police in the streets or ICE in the streets, whether it's the action of Venezuela, whether it's the way that the Trump administration is ignoring court rulings, the way he's dismissing any congressional oversight. I mean, on so many different levels, it seems like there is discontent growing. And we saw that most profoundly, I think, in the resignation of Marjorie Taylor Greene. Do you see any of that kind of pushback from Trump supporters in Minnesota because of what's happening there?
I would say that I definitely think to a certain degree, especially some of our more, I think definitely more of the conservatives who live in the cities might feel that way since they're closer to this. I do think, like, I think you're right that there is dissatisfaction. I think that in Minnesota, a lot of people, especially who live outstate, have a very biased to sort of unrealistic view of what it's like to live. Like, there's this, if you talk to a lot of people who live in sort of the suburbs around the metro or outstate, and I go out to those places semi-regularly. I know my family and people who live outside or like in South Dakota nearby. And so I've been to those small towns and I've talked to people there. And there's this overriding belief that like these cities, the Minneapolis and St. Paul, are very dangerous and that there is a lot of crime and violence. And just sort of a general sort of, and I don't really know where this comes from. I live here. We have crime. We have violence. This is nowhere close to a war zone. And there's all these thoughts that people have about how horrible things are in the Twin Cities. I think they had those ideas before this started, and I think that's influencing how they think about it now.
Yeah.
And so all I can really say to that is just like, I mean, no, this city was not a war zone until I showed up. This city was a city. You know, we had problems. Any city has problems. But there are problems that we were, as a city and as a community, working on. And the only thing that ICE's presence has done here has been making things worse. Yeah. And so that's one thing I want to communicate. Like, I know I have conservative family members. If any of you hear this, just please understand that I'm not trying to, you know, blow things up or anything. It's just that this is really terrifying. This is frightening. My parents, my friends, my family are all just sort of sick with worry. And things have been made less safe for all of us here because of what ICE is doing. And that is, I can really hope that people who aren't living here and might be hearing about this on the news, to try to accept another perspective and just kind of hear what I'm saying, that this is not something where they're fixing a problem. They are starting a problem and they're making it worse.
Zach, I got to run to a break. I really thank you so much for taking the time to join us.
You know, I'm happy to join you. Thank you so much for having me, Ed. I just hope that people can hear this and get a little more understanding of the crisis we have here in Minneapolis right now.
Folks, we've been talking with Zach Lascaris. He's an attorney and a lifelong resident of the Twin Cities. When we come back, some good news. I'm going to be talking about the Buddhist monks who are walking for peace from Texas all the way to Washington, D.C. in the months of January and February. Back in a minute on the Fallon Forum.
Thanks to Central Iowa realtor Joe Henry. Residential, commercial, land, Joe Henry's been covering all that for 23 years. He's also a leading community activist and a strong advocate for locally owned businesses. Call Joe Henry at 515-208-7312. That's 515-208-7312. You're responsible for a lot, and it's easy to become overwhelmed, to feel helpless, even hopeless. What's not so easy is finding your way back to feeling and functioning better. Psychiatrist Dr. David Drake helps individuals and couples throughout Iowa with the convenience and privacy of televideo counseling. Dr. Drake also prescribes medication when needed, and his services are offered on a self-pay, negotiated fee basis. If you need help, don't delay. Contact Dr. Drake at daviddrakefamilypsychiatry.com.
Welcome back to the Fallon Forum. Ed Fallon with you here. Hey, thanks to our sponsors, including Catholic Peace Ministry. CPM promotes peaceful resolution to war and the need to end the permanent war economy. Learn more at catholicpeaceministry.com. Thanks also to Westrum Optometry. Dr. Joel Westrum and his staff are fluent in English and Spanish. The clinic is open Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. until 5 p.m. and on Saturdays by appointment. That's Westrum Optometry.
A mission to spread peace during an over 2,000-mile walk making its way through the heart of Colombia this afternoon. That message resonating with our community. You can see hundreds of people welcoming the Buddhist monks at Gervais Street Bridge earlier today. That journey starting 3 months ago, believe it or not, out in Texas with a 2,300-mile trek to Washington, D.C. Their steps now guiding them through parts of South Carolina. And just yesterday, they were in Lexington County, drawing in crowds from both near and far.
I think it definitely gives us hope. I'm glad that we got to witness this. I think that it's going to be a part of history, a good thing to look back. But more importantly, just really hope.
Every city that these monks have traveled through, like, there's been so much outreach and like communities come together. And to see that in the city that I'm living in with my family, that's honestly an awesome experience.
I think it's great that the city came out, you know, everybody from different backgrounds coming to support the walk for peace. I think that no matter what religion you are, you should come out and just show support for peace.
People also bringing that same energy to the State House steps today as the monks brought their words of peace to the front steps. Lena Allen was there and shares how many were moved by that moment of peace.
A walk for peace, bringing hundreds together on the grounds of the State House.
It's amazing that this walk took its turn through our city and through our state in a time where we really needed it. We need it as a community.
Columbia Mayor Daniel Rickman and Senator Dion Tedder declaring January 10th the Walk of Peace Day in Columbia. That gratitude also coming from the massive crowd that came to witness the peace movement heard around the world.
For different folks and different walks of life to be here to gather peacefully, it means a lot for us, especially in front of the Capitol.
It touches you in the heart and you get goosebumps and I'll probably cry.
So far, the monks have walked 1,525 miles of their 2,300 journey. For the past 3 months, they've woken up at 4 a.m., tired and some even injured. But still, 6 states later, their message remains the same.
Let us now let go of all the hatred, all those angers. Let all those cease within loving kindness and compassion so that peace can be bloom and flourish throughout this country and around the world.
As people witness what they're describing as a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, many are hoping the Walk of Peace will inspire even greater unity throughout the nation.
If anyone sees a monk, they just need to know that they walk for peace all the time and they don't want any violence in the world.
The monks will stay overnight at the Lutheran Theological Seminary on North Main Street. The community is welcome to visit them there until 9 p.m. Lena Allen, WIS News 10.
Like so many people in that interview, I'm so inspired by the monks who are walking from Texas to Washington, D.C. for peace. There's a group of 19 monks involved. They come from the Vietnamese Buddhist temple in Fort Worth, Texas. They set out on October 26th, which interestingly was the day that I finished my 220-mile walk. Coincidence. You know, they're inspired, of course, by the teachings of Buddha, and they're aiming to raise, and I quote this, awareness of peace, loving kindness, and compassion across America and the world. So we're looking at what? Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, South Carolina, and that was Columbia, South Carolina, we heard from. And next would be North Carolina, Virginia, and then ending in Washington, D.C., where they will ask Congress to recognize Buddha's Day of Birth and Enlightenment as a federal holiday. Now, I'm pretty sure that's not going to happen, but that's a good ask, a simple one. So this is being organized as a spiritual practice, not a protest. The monks, again, they're trying to spread peace, compassion, and loving kindness through not so much public displays and conversation, but through just their silent footsteps. They have their means of support with them, but the local communities along the way have been providing tremendous hospitality, food, you know, shelter, water. And one thing they say is they only accept what's freely given, so they aren't actually asking for stuff. One quote says, quote, "The journey is a living message of mindfulness for a divided nation." And yeah, we sure are a divided nation, as we just discussed in the previous conversation. They are walking about 20 miles a day on average, which is a lot. I mean, when we did the Great March for Climate Action, that was 15.6 miles on average. We did have a day that went, I think, 24 miles. Sometimes their days are as much as 30 miles. They often sleep outdoors in their tents, but again, sometimes they're staying in local churches, community, you know, centers, universities, religious institutions. So three of the monks, I think there's 14 altogether, three of the monks are walking barefoot. They're carrying signs. They're kind of focused on silent marching. They are, as you heard, one monk did give, share some remarks at the state capitol in Columbia, South Carolina. There's some interesting stories from people along the way, including Audrey Pierce, who joined the crowd in Columbia. She drove 4 hours from Little River, and she was all teary. When one of the monks handed her a flower, she said, quote, "There's something traumatic and heart-wrenching happening in our country every day. And I looked into the eyes of the monks and I saw peace. They're putting their bodies through such physical torture, and yet they radiate peace." There was another story from a pastor in Opelika, Alabama, Pastor Patrick Hitchman Craig. He hosted the monks on Christmas night at his United Methodist Church. And, you know, he expected to see a small crowd show up to support them, but about 1,000 people showed up, you know, and he said that created the feel of a block party. He said the monks seemed like the Magi appearing on Christ's birthday. I'll read a quote from what he had to say. "Anyone who is working for peace in the world in a way that is public and sacrificial is standing close to the heart of Jesus, whether or not they share our tradition. I was blown away by the number of people and the diversity of who showed up." So it hasn't all been roses, of course. Again, some of the monks, if you look at them walking, you can see they've got bandages on their feet. There was an incident in Texas where a truck, I think it was accidental, it struck the group's escort vehicle, and that plowed into the monks, and two of them were injured. One was just treated for minor injuries, I believe, at the site. The second monk, sadly, had to be flown to hospital in Houston, had to have his leg amputated, which is terrible. So there have also been some Christian fundamentalists along the road that have shouted objections and held signs criticizing their beliefs. There's one video of a devout Baptist who's arguing with one of the monks, but it's a very polite argument, and they both express love and concern for each other. The Christian perspective this guy believes in is that anybody who doesn't accept Jesus is going to go to hell. And the monk is saying, you know, it's okay that we have differences of opinion. So I do want to play one clip relevant to that for you.
"A way of death and believing a lie. Folks, you're going to stand before the judgment seat of Christ one day, whether you like it or not. Whether you like it or not, you're going to be there, just you and God. And the only thing that's going to matter is, do you know Jesus Christ in truth? Not if you walk 2,300 miles, not if you believe we all come from energy, not if you do all the good deeds that you can think of, Not if you go and you start to do good, even though you're wicked. None of that can save you. Only Jesus, by his shed blood, who he died 2,000 years ago and rose again 3 days later in fulfillment of the scriptures, which those Buddhists reject, yet you support them. Only through him, the one who is the chief cornerstone and rejected by his own people, is salvation.
Yeah, interestingly, I mean, he was the first person I heard about who was objecting to the march was very polite and civil. And this guy, not so much. He was very accusatory. And he also seemed to be kind of on his own. I mean, by and large, nearly everybody these monks are meeting with is moved by their sacrifice, their message. And I think that's very empowering to me. It's very, very indicative of both of what a problematic position we find ourselves in these days, but also how a perspective on the importance of being peaceful oneself and grounded in one's own values, providing those values are genuinely moral and upright, how powerful that can be. So there's I will say the most popular participant in the monks' march is not one of the monks. It's a dog named Aloka. This dog is a stray dog. He was a stray dog found in India, and he did an earlier peace walk in India with one or more of these, I think just one of these monks. And there was even a sign in one of the videos, Aloka for president. So just as of today, Monday, the 12th of January, the dog is undergoing surgery for a leg injury. And I can't imagine how tough it is to walk 20 miles a day as a human and as a dog with much shorter legs. Yeah, you've got four of them instead of two, but still 20 miles a day, 30 miles a day. That's really tough. And I speak from some experience on that because my son, Ben, and his dog, Diggy, joined us on the Great March for Climate Action back in August of 2014. And we walked 52 miles in under 48 hours. It was 3 days. We started one day quite late and then finished the final day, around mid-afternoon. So in 48 hours, we'd walked 52 miles, and that dog did every step of the way. But as my son said, he was dog tired. So this is very encouraging to me. And, so what is the appeal of this walk? I guess it could be the uniqueness. A bunch of guys in orange robes and bald heads walking with bare feet in some cases. There's a certain discipline to it. They don't walk side by side. They walk in a single file. They aren't talking. They're focused on their walking as meditation, as prayer. I've been involved with two long marches back in 1987, coordinating the Iowa stretch of the Great Peace March. And of course, in 2014, organizing and doing the Great March for Climate Action. And on both marches, there was always some sense of confrontation, some sense of we're right, you're wrong. And yeah, I do believe that our positions are right. But I think perhaps sometimes the confrontation wasn't the best approach. And maybe this approach is more effective in terms of getting people to accept the value of what you're trying to teach, what you're trying to convey. Anyway, I'm very moved by it, and I know a lot of people around the country have been. I kind of wish they were coming through Iowa. I'm not inclined to head out to North Carolina to catch the next week of the march, but I think what they're doing is very cool, and I hope when they get to Washington, D.C., they're not all rounded up and put into detention and deported. We'll see. I mean, I don't hold anything, I don't rule out any possibility. I got to take a short break. Ed Found again with you here. When we come back, we're going to be talking about some concerns about the Trump administration versus the Constitution and the rule of law regarding what's happening in county jails in Iowa and elsewhere around the country. Thank you.
Catholic Peace Ministry is an independent nonprofit guided by an ecumenical board representing many faith traditions. Founded in 1980, Catholic Peace Ministry focuses on nuclear disarmament and ending the wars between Israel and Hamas and Russia and Ukraine. CPM's overarching concern is the need to end the permanent war economy, which must be challenged if we are to achieve lasting peace and justice. Learn more at CatholicPeaceMinistry.com.
At Westrom Optometry, Dr. Joel Westrom and his team provide a variety of services, including comprehensive eye exams, children's eye exams, and LASIK co-management. Whether strictly utilitarian or a fashion statement, your comfort and vision are Westrom's primary concern. Dr. Westrom and his staff will work closely with you to determine the best solution for your eyes, prescription, and lifestyle. Services are provided in English and Spanish, and the clinic is open Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. till 5 p.m. and on Saturdays by appointment. That's Westrom Optometry, located in Des Moines East Village. Welcome back to the Fallon Forum. Ed Fallon with you here, folks. Hey, thanks again to our partners and sponsors, including Story County Veterinary Clinic, where Dr. Kim Holding has been caring for all creatures, great and small, for over 30 years. Learn more at Story County Veterinary Clinic's Facebook page. Thanks also to Architecture by Synthesis. Owner Mark Klipsham asks that you use the most energy-efficient methods you can afford and the greenest, longest-lasting materials available. Mark's work can be found at architecturebysynthesis.com. All right, so here in central Iowa, and actually elsewhere in Iowa, Sioux City, Muscatine, other counties, there are numerous lawsuits being filed by jail inmates who are there as part of the ICE detention initiative. They are all alleging that they have been unlawfully detained in county jails. And I suspect that there's a lot of empathy from the county jail officials and the county boards of supervisors, because I mean in Des Moines, in Polk County, I mean we're a county of just over 500,000 people. There's a capacity right now there are 993 people imprisoned in the Polk County Jail, which is a lot. But of that 993, 68 of those are people being detained by ICE. And the argument is, again, the Trump administration is always coming up with new ways of describing things that are basically either unconstitutional or illegal. They've come up with something called, quote, mandatory detention. It's a theory that says that they're entitled to be able to hold these detainees, with disregard for previous precedent. So, again, the precedent is that they get released on bail and then come back for hearing. So instead of doing that, they're being kept in jails. And I presume, I don't know whether the federal government is reimbursing the county governments for the cost of housing these inmates. I presume they might be, I'm not sure. But to show you how inconsistent this, quote, mandatory detention theory is with even current practice, more than 300 federal judges. Now, and that includes judges appointed by every president since Ronald Reagan. So George Bush Sr., George Bush the Younger, maybe even Trump, I'm not sure. But 300 federal judges have rejected the mandatory detention theory. And how many cases? 1,600. So there have been 1,600 times in which people jailed, arguably wrongly, by ICE. And the judges are ruling in favor of the detainees. And yet the federal government is requiring them to stay there in prison, in jail. That's worth repeating. More than 300 federal judges, including appointees of every president since Ronald Reagan, have rejected the Trump administration's mandatory detention theory in over 1,600 cases. So one of the cases here in Des Moines recently, it's a newly filed case involving Ulysses Ramirez Cruz. It was a traffic stop, and I can't remember what the charge was, but he was put in Polk County Jail, even though it was asked that he be released on bond. ICE refused to release him. The guy had been in Iowa for 5 years, and I don't know his status. And even if he is here illegally, even if he applied for asylum and that process is still in the works, he should be given that chance. That historically is how it operates. So here's how it happened, I guess. ICE agents were just kind of hanging outside his house, waiting for him. And he gets out of his house. This is back on November 7th. He pulls, he got out of the house, got in his car, drove away, and then ICE officials pulled him over. So there's a district court judge here, Stephen Locker. He directed the immigration court to provide Cruz with an opportunity to argue for his release on bond while the underlying immigration case proceeded. Again, court ruling. Trump administration ignored it. They ignored it. That is a violation of the Constitution. That is a violation of a court ruling. We are supposed to have courts in this country and Congress, legislative branch, and the administrative branch. We have all kinds of divisions of responsibility that create this system of checks and balances that prevent us from falling into, you know, and an authoritarian government. And so I don't know how you can look at something like this and not realize, yeah, we are heading toward, if we're not there already, authoritarianism. I mean, these rulings in 300 judges, 1,600 cases, clear. And still, the Trump administration just ignoring them. So there was a second case involving a Polk County jail inmate named Luis Pedroso. He's from Cuba. He's been in the U.S. for 4.5 years. He applied for status as a legal permanent resident. But as part of the approval process, he was supposed to prove that he's not ineligible on public health grounds. Apparently, that would involve a physical examination to rule out drug abuse and communicable diseases. That's a nuance I'm not familiar with. But under federal regs, that examination must be provided by a physician selected by or approved by immigration authorities. So attorneys for Pedroso argue that the jail, the Polk County Jail, also Polk County Health Department and ICE are all unwilling or unable to provide Pedroso with a physician so the examination can be conducted. And ICE is also unwilling to transfer Pedroso to a different jail so the examination can take place. So, you know, I wonder what all this is costing the taxpayers. I mean, that's a secondary question. It's the cost, the human cost is what's really troubling. So Pedroso's attorneys claim that ICE and the county have, in effect, denied Pedroso his status as a legal permanent resident and violated his right to due process. So, again, he is a legal permanent resident. And one of the lawsuit says, quote, keeping Pedroso in detention for the purpose of adjudicating his claim in immigration court transforms his detention into a punitive detention intending to punish him for the fact that he is eligible for legal permanent residency. Okay, that's a lot of words. There's a third case here in Polk County as well, a guy named Amir Rahimi. He's from Centerville. Somehow he's here in the jail in Polk County. He's a native of Iran. And in his lawsuit, he alleges that he's been married to a native-born U.S. citizen for 33 years, with whom he has 3 children. The couple's eldest son is in the U.S. Air Force and is currently deployed overseas. Rahimi alleges he was detained by federal agents when he stopped at an ICE office for a routine scheduled appointment. And at that time, he claims ICE gave no reason for his detention except to tell him they were currently, quote, seeking a third country for your removal. Again, 33 years, a U.S. citizen. Married, 3 children. You know, this stuff is clearly violating the law. I don't know where it goes from here, folks, but it's important to expose it and to push back against it. Short break here, folks. When I come back, Kathy Burns is going to join me. We're going to be talking about the new food pyramid that RFK Jr. has introduced and how it kind of flips things upside down. Back in a minute on the Fallon Forum. Architecture by Synthesis provides planning, design, and design build services for high performance, low maintenance, affordable homes and buildings. Owner Mark Clipsham asks that you use the most energy efficient methods you can afford and the greenest, longest lasting materials available. Examples of Mark's work can be found at architecturebysynthesis.com. That's architecturebysynthesis.com.
At Story County Veterinary Clinic, Dr. Kim Holding has over 30 years of experience working with all creatures, great and small. Cat, dog, horse, cow, elephant. Well, if you've got a pet elephant, you may be in trouble. Kim's clients stick with her year after year because they know she'll do right by them and their pets and farm animals. So give Kim a shout to keep your animals happy and healthy. Call 515-232-8766. That's 232-8766.
Welcome back to the Fallon Forum. Hey, thanks to our sponsors, including psychiatrist Dr. David Drake. If you live in Iowa, Dr. Drake can help through the convenience and privacy of televideo counseling offered on a self-pay negotiated fee basis. Contact DavidDrakeFamilyPsychiatry.com. Hey, Kathy Burns, welcome to the program.
Thanks.
You've been looking at pyramids.
I haven't even traveled to do it.
You haven't even been to Egypt yet.
Or the Mayan ruins
in Mexico.
That would be lovely to see.
The dietary pyramid.
Yeah, we're talking about the new food pyramid that RFK and company has just released. And it's funny that they're talking about the new food pyramid that they flipped on its head because the food pyramid hadn't been being used most recently. There's quite an interesting history of the food recommendations from the government.
Why did we abandon it?
The old one?
Yeah.
Well, let's get to that in
okay.
a little bit.
All right.
It's interesting to think about the first food recommendation that the feds came out with, and that was in 1943.
Really?
And it
during the war.
Yeah, and it wasn't about which foods are best for you as much as stay as healthy as you can while we're rationing food because we're fighting World War II. And that's that's why that had to be. And it's more of a pie chart, and it has seven food groups, and they're very similar to the ones that we're used to. Ranked 1 to 7 because you're going to have more green and yellow vegetables available to you in your in your own garden that you grow outside your back door because it's World War II and they had the
victory gardens.
So that was indicated as very important, followed by strangely, oranges, tomatoes, grapefruit, the vitamin C, don't get scurvy, whatever you do. Group 3 was potatoes and other vegetables and fruit. That was interesting. Potatoes are right up there because that's what people could grow. Then milk and milk products. That's a little harder to get. That might be more rationed. Then meat, poultry, fish or eggs, and then bread, flour, and cereals. And that's because they had to ship a lot of that overseas to feed the troops.
Ah, okay, so
similar to World War One.
Yeah.
So they didn't make any recommendations about portion sizes, but in 1955, some new guidelines that was actually shaped like a pyramid or a triangle was introduced, reducing it from 7 categories to just 4, milk, meat, vegetable and fruit, and bread and cereal. So that's a little easier. It recommended different portions for different age levels. And then 92 came what we know as the food
really
pyramid.
Not until 1992. I thought I remembered a food pyramid when I was a kid, but maybe I'm making that up.
There was sort of an interim one, and it was based on some work that a Swedish nutritionist was doing, and the government played around with that and had a couple of iterations. But in 92 is when the food pyramid with the six groups now. They always change, featuring bread, rice, cereal. And it's funny because they put those at the bottom, meaning that's the base of your diet.
Grains.
The grains.
Yeah.
And so they have the biggest portion of the pyramid at the bottom, and then working the way up, fruits and vegetables, and then meats and dairy, and then snacks and fats and sweets.
Okay. And so meat and dairy were like five from the bottom, and fats and sweets were at the top, it looks like. Okay.
Mm-hmm. And then 2011 was introduced the healthy eating plate, or what we called my plate, and it looked like a plate of dinner plate, and it portioned it out.
Well, nice that people are eating on plates and not on TV trays.
Well, what's different about the new Health and Human Services Department and USDA issued, they say they have flipped the food pyramid on its head. So to me, graphically, that kind of makes sense, because you want the most important thing at the top, right? Of a diagram, people
okay.
Read from top to bottom and left to right.
Right.
But now it just looks like a triangle. It doesn't look like a pyramid at all. So quite a bit has changed with this flip.
And I've heard some people, I've not studied it, but I've heard some people say that they don't necessarily disagree with RFK's positioning of food in this way.
I don't agree. I don't disagree with all of it, but you can see who their favorites are. Big Ag and Big Dairy. So right at the top is the proteins, and they emphasize prioritize protein at every meal. And at the top left corner, and because people
a
read
steak, I see
people
it.
Read top to bottom, left to right, the top left corner is a big steak.
And then there's an entire rotisserie chicken in there.
There's a big chicken,
a whole chicken.
And there's a meatloaf.
Meatloaf. Yeah,
the funny thing is that with the proteins, I don't see any legumes on there at all. And the nuts are down, way down with the fruits and vegetables. Then at the bottom, small portion is the whole grains.
So they're saying those are what we should be eating most of? But you know, so it's meat and broccoli.
Well,
and broccoli and carrots and a tomato at the very top.
Meat and fruits and vegetables, and that's fine. But this prioritized protein at every meal. And then also making sure that when you prepare your foods that you're getting the fats that have been the taboo fats for quite a while. We're talking about meat-based fats. And guess what? The darling of the not just
it's not bacon,
JFK.
Is it? It's not bacon?
It's beef tallow.
Oh, beef tallow beat out bacon?
Well, in 2024, on Thanksgiving Day, RFK had himself videoed. He was barefoot, and he had a big vat of beef tallow, and he was submerging to deep fry his entire Thanksgiving turkey in beef tallow.
While doing a pull-up with one arm?
Probably. I think he was shirtless in that video.
Okay.
So the thing is, this is a little anti-science, because although the release that they issued when they put this diagram out there says that it's supposed to be based on modern nutrition science, let's just think about protein. I can't prioritize protein at every meal. It'll kill my kidney, and I only have one.
Right.
So that's quite a bit. Not everybody's a bodybuilder. Not everybody needs protein
right.
at every meal.
Yeah. Okay. And some of the stuff, like limit highly processed foods.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
I agree.
Including limiting sugars, limiting artificial additives.
Mm-hmm.
Choose water over carbonated sweetened beverages.
Yeah.
Limit alcohol consumption. They don't say to how much, but a lot of that makes sense.
Yes, it does.
And there's no ultra-processed foods in this pyramid, or whatever it is now that it's upside down.
And I agree that we've talked about this a lot, Ed. Ultra-processed foods are not good for us. I stop at processed food, which for me means pie.
Pie.
So all people right. should take a look and see what they think.
Yeah, Kathy, thanks for that information. Thanks, folks, for tuning into today's program. Thanks to our guest today, Zach Lascaris. And to our production team of Sherry Herdina, Forrest Dederman, Charles Goldman, Kathy, and myself, Ed Fallon. Thanks also to our local small business partners, Gateway Marketing Cafe, Story County Veterinary Clinic, Western Optometry, David Drake Family Psychiatry, Architecture by Synthesis, and real estate agent Joe Henry. Thanks also to our nonprofit partners, Catholic Peace Ministry, Iowa Physicians for Social Responsibility, Bold Iowa, Birds and Bees Urban Farm, and Climate March. And finally, thanks to the Des Moines Irish Session for providing our bumper music. We'll be back next week with another hour of Cutting Edge Talk Radio.